Thank you.
Thank you, Bill, for the introduction. I'd also like to thank the Scotch-Irish Society of the United States of America for inviting me to give this lecture as part of this weekend's conference here in Glaxman Ireland House, From Migration to Music, the Scotch-Irish Contributions to America. And that conference, in turn, is part of the Carnegie Hall series, Migrations, the Making of America, a citywide festival running from March through May, with concerts and performances of Scottish, Irish, Jewish, and African American music at Carnegie Hall, and literally hundreds of public lectures, performances, exhibitions, and events. I think there are 100 partner institutions around the city for the festival. So I'd like to thank the organizers of that festival for inviting Glaxman Ireland House to participate. Consul General Kieran Madden, thank you for your support, as always, of Ireland House and of the conference this weekend. And finally, it would be customary at this point for the speaker to thank the director of Glaxman Ireland House for his hospitality, but as I am fortunate enough to occupy that role, I will proceed straight to the lecture. So, the story of the American Irish often, I would say usually, begins in the 1840s with the Great Famine. But as everyone in this room this evening knows, Irish migration to America had assumed the character of a mass movement a century before that, really from 1720 onwards. If you were to stop the clock in the year 1800 and look for Irish America, you would find it in Pennsylvania and points south, and you would find that about three-quarters of the people involved were Protestant, mostly Presbyterians from the northern province of Ulster. The figures are disputed. Some estimates for Irish emigration in the 18th century run as high as 400,000. The more conservative estimate would be between 60,000 and 100,000 before the Revolution, another 100,000 to 150,000 from 1783 onwards after the Revolutionary War. So even the conservative estimate would be somewhere between 200,000 and 250,000 people for the 18th century as a whole, dominated, as we know, by Presbyterians. That figure may strike you as a little low compared to the age of mass migration. The age of mass migration is 1820 to 1920, when almost 5 million Irish people left for North America. But the population of Ulster in 1750 was about 500,000 people. The population of Ireland was about 2.5 million people. So without going into the numbers in further detail, the point is that the rate of emigration from Ireland, the number of people leaving as a percentage of the population, was as high in the 18th century as most of the 19th century. So it has a considerable impact on both sides of the Atlantic. We know from rough estimates, they're based on surname analysis, so that's a bit slippery, as you can imagine, and there's confusion between Ulster and Scotland in particular, but the best estimates on surname analysis indicate that between 14 and 17% of the white population of the United States was of Irish origin in 1790, at the time of the first census. The dominant presence, again, being Ulster Presbyterians, about 10%. What's interesting and really striking to me as a historian is that on both sides of the Atlantic, Ulster Presbyterians served as a buffer between zones of perceived civility and barbarity. They separated Anglicans from Catholics in Ulster. They separated Eastern elites from Native Americans in Pennsylvania in particular. And Pennsylvania was the principal zone of settlement. Ulster's transatlantic trade was oriented to the Delaware ports. Pennsylvania was the most religiously tolerant place in America, possibly in the world, maybe some competition from the Dutch, but one of the most religiously tolerant places in the world. And the colony was eager to attract settlers and therefore provided land on attractive terms. In search of more land on even more attractive terms, Ulster migrants quickly began to migrate out of southeastern Pennsylvania, where they arrived, moving westward across the Susquehanna River into the Cumberland Valley, where the European population by 1750 was overwhelmingly composed of Ulster settlers and their descendants. They also moved south, and again, this is a familiar story to many people at the conference this weekend, all the way down through the Appalachian backcountry, first through Maryland, through the Shenandoah Valley or Great Valley of Western Virginia, into the Carolinas and Georgia, eventually westward to Kentucky and Tennessee. By 1790, again, the first census year, an estimated 50% of white settlers on the trans-Appalachian frontier were of Ulster origin. In western Pennsylvania and in the backcountry of North Carolina and Virginia, they made up three-quarters of the white population. So, as one historian has remarked, a map of their settlements is almost a map of the pre-revolutionary frontier. Now, the Ulster Irish played an important but complicated and multifaceted role in American history during the Revolutionary era, more often as patriots than as loyalists, but not always, more often as anti-federalist critics of the new national government than as federalist proponents of the Constitution, but not always. How the Ulster Irish refer to themselves is an important and fascinating question. Indeed, they used so many different terms for this purpose, all of them with some merit, none without controversy, that one historian has referred to them as the people with no name. Our hosts for the conference this weekend used the term Scotch-Irish. A variant on this term, Scots-Irish, I think is more common in Ireland, but I'm not sure about that. Another possibility is Ulster-Scots. Now, all three terms refer to the fact that the parents or grandparents of those who emigrated to America had first moved to Ulster from Scotland in the 17th century. And these Scottish settlers moved to Ireland for precisely the same reasons as their descendants moved to America one or two generations later. First, they wanted land to call their own. Second, they wanted a place in which they could practice their religion without fear of discrimination or persecution. In Ulster, they achieved these goals only to a limited extent. Most of the Ulster Scots ended up renting their land as tenants rather than owning it. And although the threat of outright persecution faded in the 18th century, they lacked basic civil and political privileges as dissenters from the established Anglican Church of Ireland. If asked to describe themselves, I think they would often have used a religious term, Presbyterian, or dissenter, or Northern dissenter, rather than an ethno-geographical term like Ulster Scots. Presbyterians were Protestants, to be sure, but they were Protestants of the wrong kind. Economically, socially, politically, religiously, they occupied an intermediate status between the Catholic masses and the Anglican elite. In the American colonies, and especially Pennsylvania, they knew they had a better chance of finding the two essential things lacking at home, adequate land and religious toleration. We should not forget finally, that before the era of mass Catholic immigration began, the Ulster Irish were the American Irish. The distinction didn't need to be made. There is evidence to suggest, but I leave this to the experts tomorrow, there's evidence that the term Scotch-Irish had negative anti-Presbyterian connotations in the 18th century. I've certainly encountered evidence in my own research to suggest that, and was appropriated as a badge of pride by people of Ulster origin only in the 19th century to mark themselves off as different from the Catholic Irish who were then arriving in large numbers. Before the age of mass Catholic emigration, therefore, many contemporaries in colonial America referred to immigrants from Ulster simply as the Irish. And as my lecture will illustrate, they sometimes referred to them as the Wild Irish. So that wasn't reserved for later periods. So this evening, I want to tell one story in the larger history of the Scots-Irish. And it's a story about Indian killers in Pennsylvania. Let me be quite clear at the outset that I'm not suggesting that this story somehow represents the entire complex history of a group. On the contrary, there's obviously much more to Scots-Irish history than the story I will be telling. But because so many Scots-Irish people lived on the American frontier, where they interacted in an unusually intense and violent way with Native Americans, the story of the Paxton Boys is one important part of the larger history, and it's one we need to address directly. The Paxton Boys struck Conestoga Indian Town at dawn on December 14, 1763. Benjamin Franklin described the scene a few months later in his narrative of the late massacres in Lancaster County. 57 men from some of our frontier townships who had projected the destruction of this little commonwealth came all well mounted and armed with firelocks, hangers, and hatchets, having traveled through the country in the night to Conestoga Manor. Only six of the Conestogas were in the town at the time, the rest, quote, being out among the neighboring white people, some to sell baskets, brooms, and bowls they manufactured. The Paxton Boys, frontier militiamen on an unauthorized expedition, killed these six and burned the settlement to the ground. The Conestogas, a remnant of the once powerful Susquehannocks, lived on a 500-acre tract near the town of Lancaster, which William Penn had set aside for them around 1690. Penn confirmed this agreement by treaty in 1701, shortly before he left Pennsylvania after his second and last visit to the colony. By 1763, only 20 people were living in Conestoga Indian Town, 7 men, 5 women, and 8 children. They survived by raising a little corn, begging at local farms, soliciting food and clothing from the provincial government, and selling their homemade brooms and baskets. After the first massacre, local magistrates removed the remaining 14 Conestoga Indians to the Lancaster jail and workhouse for their safety. But on December 27th, 2 weeks after the first massacre, the Paxton Boys rode into town and finished the job they had started 2 weeks earlier. 50 men, Franklin observed, armed as before, dismounting, went directly to the workhouse and by violence broke open the door and entered with the utmost fury in their countenances. Within a matter of minutes, they had killed the 14 Conestogas sheltering inside, including the 8 children. Now, very little is known about the Paxton Boys as individuals, but their general profile is clear. They lived in the hill country of Pennsylvania's Susquehanna Valley in northwest Lancaster County, and then across the river in Cumberland County. Western settlement at this time barely extended beyond the valley of the Susquehanna River. So present-day Lancaster and Harrisburg, which are about 100 miles west of Pennsylvania, constituted the frontier at that time. The town of Harrisburg was known at that time as Harris's Ferry or Paxton. So the Paxton boys originated in what is today Paxton Township, you see there along the Susquehanna River in what is today Harrisburg. So Western settlement at the time did not extend beyond the river, a little bit into Cumberland County. And this was the region that contemporaries refer to as the frontier. That term is in all the sources, a zone of violent conflict between European settlers and Native Americans. And this was the area that was the first to be attacked when war broke out, as it did frequently in the 18th century, when Native Americans declared war on Pennsylvania. Some of the Paxton boys were squatters, as I'll explain. Others farmed small plots of low-quality land. The land in Lancaster County is some of the richest and most fertile on earth, but as you drive out of Lancaster County into towards the river, you begin to move on an uphill gradient into hill country. That's where trouble begins, and the land quality is poor there as well. They detested the provincial government in Philadelphia, who they felt were just really leaving them defenseless during time of warfare. Most, I would say, probably all, because I haven't found evidence to the contrary, most of the Paxton boys were the American-born children of settlers who came from Ulster. So they weren't migrants from Ulster. They were their American-born children. It's a very American story in so many ways, as you'll see. Contemporary accounts all agreed that the Paxton boys were Scotch-Irish Presbyterians. So that was the description in all the sources. When they killed the last of the Conestogas in 1763, the Paxton boys were fully aware of the symbolic significance of their actions. They targeted defenseless, non-belligerent Indians to make the point that, from their perspective, all Native Americans were the same. They did so on government property, a workhouse, in broad daylight, to advertise their defiance of the authorities and their repudiation of the policies of William Penn. So William Penn is the founder of Pennsylvania, and here you see him pictured in 1682 at a legendary, probably mythical meeting with the Lenni Lenape, who we know better as the Delaware Indians, the Lenape Indians, under the elm tree in Philadelphia. Inspired by Quaker principles, Penn founded his colony as a holy experiment in which Christians and Native Americans could supposedly live together in harmony. And he referred to this ideal society as the Peaceable Kingdom, which is why I use the title in my book, Peaceable Kingdom Lost. It's the story of the unraveling of that experiment. The 19th century Quaker artist Edward Hicks produced a series of allegorical paintings of the Peaceable Kingdom. In fact, there are 60 of these paintings survive, based on a theme from the Book of Isaiah, in which he always included Penn's meeting with the Lenape as a detail. You see in the background is William Penn meeting the Lenape Indians. The biblical reference is to Isaiah book 11 verse 6, the wolf shall also dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. So this is the vision of the peaceable kingdom. In pursuit of this vision, Penn treated the Native Americans in Pennsylvania with unusual respect by the standards of the time. And what I mean by that is he purchased land from them fairly and openly by treaty. He didn't simply go in and expropriate it, which he could have done. Yet, the holy experiment really couldn't have worked in practice because it rested on firmly colonialist foundations. There would have been no Pennsylvania, after all, if William Penn had not received a gift of 29 million acres from Charles II in 1681 to pay off a debt. And this gift made William Penn the largest individual landlord in the British Empire. He didn't simply seize the land that he was given. He did engage in treaty negotiations with Native Americans, but again, he did not do so simply out of benevolence. He needed to free the land of prior titles so that he could sell it to settlers and recoup the expenses involved in setting up a colony and try and make some sort of a profit. The problem is Penn wanted harmony with Native Americans, but he also needed to own their land outright. Native Americans, for the most part, saw land as a tribal trust. They did not believe it could be owned by individuals, that it could be alienated from any party to another individual party. When they ceded land to the Penn family by treaty in return for financial or non-monetary compensation, they generally regarded the arrangement as temporary rather than permanent. In the sources, I've seen examples where the same piece of land was sold three times. Right, so it would be sold, and then the Native Americans would come back and say, oh, that piece of land, we'll sell that to you. The Penn family would say, well, we have a deed. We did this 25 years ago, but the outcome is we'll do it again. Right? It's more tactful to do it again. So I've seen that in the sources. So in a context like that, the peaceable kingdom really couldn't take root. It was already in decline by the time of William Penn's death in 1718. It disintegrated gradually over the next few decades. It collapsed entirely during the warfare of the 1750s and 60s. William Penn's son and principal heir, Thomas, quickly cast off the Quaker faith and reverted to Anglicanism. Unhampered by religious scruples, Thomas Penn and his brothers continued to negotiate with Native Americans, but they did not hesitate to use fraud and intimidation. For example, in 1737, the Penns swindled the Lenape out of a huge tract of land in a sordid transaction known as the Walking Purchase. So in the Walking Purchase, what happened was the group of Lenape Indians were essentially browbeaten into agreeing that a disputed tract of land would be surveyed. And they agreed to do this, and for them, the measure of the land in question would be how much a man could cover in a day's walk. That's why it's called the Walking Purchase. When the day for the survey came, Thomas Penn sent out three walkers with supply horses and guides, essentially relay runners. They eventually encircled an area the size of Rhode Island. That's the Walking Purchase of 1737. And within 5 years of the Walking Purchase, the Delaware Indians had been forced out of their homelands, mostly west of the Susquehanna River. When they declared war on Pennsylvania 20 years later, the Walking Purchase was their principal grievance. Now this, I think, is an appropriate moment for me to share with you a statement agreed upon by my colleagues in the History Department just this year concerning Native American land rights. It's quite interesting. The NYU Department of History acknowledges that it is located in ancestral Lenape homelands. That's the same group I'm talking about this evening. And it recognizes the long-standing significance of these lands for Lenape nations past and present. We are also conscious that New York City has the largest urban Native population in the United States, and that I would have had no idea about. Perhaps it makes sense just on in terms of scale, but the point is that the history that I'm sharing with you this evening is live. It's all around us. It's kind of under our feet. If the Penn family represented one threat to Pennsylvania's Native Americans, settlers from Ulster posed an even more direct and violent threat. Ulster Presbyterians began to arrive in Pennsylvania at the beginning of the 18th century. Those who moved west set up as squatters, paying no attention to land titles. As the provincial secretary James Logan put it in 1730, these Scotch-Irish settlers, quote, sit frequently down on any spot of vacant land they can find without asking questions. So on the frontier, there's basically no government of a European kind, and the settlers take advantage of that vacuum by claiming their land by tomahawk right. So that's the, as far as title goes. You take an axe, you carve your initials in it in a tree, and you go to a tree 100 yards away, and then the territory demarcated is your claim. Obviously, that leads to conflict with the Penn family in Philadelphia, but also with the Native Americans in place who are using the land. In December 1730, a generation before the Conestoga massacres, a group of Ulster settlers from the Paxton region moved south and occupied Conestoga Manor, where the Conestogas were living peacefully under the Penn family's protection. The intruders, James Logan wrote, believed that it was, quote, against the laws of God and nature that so much land should lie idle while so many Christians wanted it to labor on and raise their bread. That's really the ethos of the Paxton Boys in one quote, against the laws of God and nature. I played with that as a title for the book, actually. Couldn't quite get it right. Against the laws of God and nature, that so much land should lie idle, while so many Christians wanted it to labor on and raise their bread. With the outbreak of the French and Indian War in 1754, known as the Seven Years' War in Europe, Native Americans in western Pennsylvania were forced to choose sides. Expelled from their lands in the east, the Lenape sided with the French as the lesser of two evils and launched devastating raids on settlers all along the Pennsylvania frontier. In Philadelphia, the provincial government responded by declaring war and for the first time establishing a provincial militia. Remember, this is a Quaker colony, so it did not have a militia for the first 70 years of its existence. A handful of strict Quaker activists remained true to William Penn's vision that the peaceable kingdom was at an end. Now, frontier settlers did most of the fighting, and from their perspective, both the assembly, which was dominated by the Quakers, and the executive branch, which was run by the Penn family, were callously indifferent to their fate throughout that war. By 1763, however, the British had defeated the French and their Native American allies, and for a moment, at least, it looked as though tranquility was about to return to Pennsylvania.
Thank you for listening to This Irish American Life, folks. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan Gray, and we're currently listening to a lecture delivered by Professor Kevin Kenny as part of the Scotch-Irish of America Symposium, which was held recently at Luxman Ireland House. Now we'll return to that lecture. Enjoy, folks.
And no sooner had the British secured imperial mastery over North America in 1763, however, then the short-sighted policies of Sir Geoffrey Amherst helped trigger Pontiac's War, the largest Native American rebellion in colonial American history. Lenape, and Shawnee warriors launched raids once again east of the Susquehanna River, and it was in this context, in December 1763, that the Paxton Boys exterminated the last of the Conestogas. So, in the context of Pontiac's War in the summer of 1763, the provincial government in Philadelphia authorized the creation of two militia units in the Susquehanna Valley. And the two leading Presbyterian figures in the valley were appointed to recruit and command the men. Colonel John Armstrong in Carlisle, the hero of the French and Indian War, and in Paxton, the Reverend John Elder, the fighting pastor of Paxton Presbyterian Church. I don't know if any of you have visited the church. It's still there. Elder was 57 years old by this time, which was older in those days than it is now. therefore, he was not expected to engage in military combat, but he did. He was expected to recruit the men. Now, local settlers had already banded together in volunteer groups known as the Cumberland Boys, west of the river, the Paxton Rangers, or the Paxton Boys in Lancaster County. And Elder and Armstrong organized these and other men into the two militia units authorized by the Assembly. The units were about 50 men each. They were intended by the Assembly to be used for strictly defensive purposes. But what Elder and Armstrong wanted was an offensive force that would launch punitive expeditions against Native Americans. If the government refused this request, they were prepared to act unilaterally. And they did. So in August, September and October of 1763, the Paxton Boys and the Cumberland Boys launched a series of unauthorized but successful raids against Lenape Indians living in Moravian mission towns along the Susquehanna River. So these were Indians who had converted to Christianity, whom they believed were cooperating with the enemy. The Assembly actually shared that suspicion, but instead of recommending punitive raids, it recommended that the Native Americans be removed from the Moravian missions and placed in protective custody in Philadelphia. So they were duly removed, 149 of them, and put in quarantine in the Province Island Pest House just outside the city. Okay, so they're removed. The Paxton Boys are still looking for a target, perhaps a symbolic target, and 45 miles downriver from Paxton, the Conestogas are also under suspicion. The bands of rangers patrolling the countryside accused them of spying, harboring enemies, planning, possibly participating in attacks on local settlers. Conestoga Indian Town, once a crossroads of diplomacy and trade, was by now in permanent decline. A younger faction had several times considered abandoning the town, but the Conestoga's headman, who had met William Penn as a child, he's very old by the 1760s, he wanted to renew the covenant made with the Penn family. As he put it, a fire was kindled at Conestoga that had burned a long while. He'd been born there himself, he'd lived there all his life, and he intended, as he said, to stay and lay his bones at Conestoga. And so the Conestogas stayed. And the Paxton Boys descended on Conestoga Indian Town on the morning of December 14th, 1763, killed the Indians they found there, and burned the settlement to the ground. Among the documents found in the remains was a parchment copy dated April 23rd, 1701, of the foundational treaty with William Penn, which was one of the most prized possessions of the Conestogas. 2 weeks later, they attacked the Lancaster workhouse. So who was responsible? The two men most likely to know the answer to this question were John Armstrong and John Elder. Both pleaded ignorance, telling Governor John Penn, a grandson of William Penn, that they knew nothing. Penn was not convinced. Most reports at the time indicated that two men were had led the Paxton boys, Matthew Smith and somebody called Lazarus Stewart. So Matthew Smith and Lazarus Stewart. Governor Penn removed Elder from office, fired him. John Armstrong, despite the questions, stayed in charge of the provincial forces west of the river. At the end of January 1764, reports reached Philadelphia that hundreds, perhaps thousands, of Paxton boys were on the march, demanding the right to inspect the Moravian Delaware Indians in protective custody, threatening to sack the city unless their other grievances were met. John Penn appointed Benjamin Franklin to organize a volunteer militia to defend the city. To the subsequent delight and ridicule of their critics, many Quakers took up arms to defend Philadelphia, opening themselves to the charge that pacifist principles applied only when frontiersmen were suffering, not when Quakers were under direct threat. The next day, several hundred Paxton boys reached Germantown, at that time 6 miles northwest of the city limits, where a delegation led by Franklin persuaded them to write down their grievances. The Paxton boys' spokesmen, Matthew Smith and James Gibson, submitted a declaration and a remonstrance for consideration by the provincial government. And instead of a war of weapons, what followed was a war of words. The most extraordinary pamphlet war in 18th century American history. In exchange of 60 pamphlets and 10 political cartoons, which were a newish genre at the time, in which Presbyterian supporters of the Paxton boys, in uneasy alliance with the Anglican faction surrounding the Penn family, did battle with Franklin and the Quaker Party. Franklin was the first to publish. "If an Indian injures me," he asked in his narrative, "does it follow that I may revenge that injury on all Indians? It is well known that Indians are of different tribes, nations, and languages, as well as the white people. If the French, who are white people, injured the Dutch, should the Dutch take revenge on the English, because they, too, are white people?" The Conestogas had committed no crime, Franklin continued, other than having a reddish-brown skin and black hair. And some people of that sort, it seems, had murdered some of our relations. By the Paxton boys' logic, if a man with a freckled face and red hair, the stereotypical Ulster, or at that time simply Irish complexion, should kill Franklin's wife and child, it would be right for him, quote, to revenge it by killing all the freckled, red-haired men, women, and children he could find. The Paxton boys, rather than their Native American victims, Franklin concluded, were the true savages. The Conestogas had offered hospitality to William Penn, and Pennsylvania had offered them protection in return. But, quote, "the mangled corpses of the last remains of the tribe demonstrated how effectually we have afforded it to them." The Conestogas, quote, "would have been safe in any part of the known world except in the neighborhood of the Christian white savages of Paxton and Donegal," end quote. The Reverend Thomas Barton of Lancaster, an Anglican clergyman who owed his career to the Penn family, responded directly to Franklin's narrative And throughout his pamphlet and the pamphlet war that followed, Barton and his allies emphasized Native American savagery, as they put it, as a way of diminishing the Paxton boys' brutality. They blamed the Quakers for the government's failure to provide adequate frontier defense. They ridiculed the Quakers who had taken up arms. They insisted that there was no meaningful distinction between a friendly and an enemy Indian. And they praised the Paxton boys for their Ulster Presbyterian pedigree and their loyalty to the Crown. Okay, so that's one side of the debate. They finally defended the actions of the Paxton boys as legitimate opposition to bad government in a Presbyterian tradition. Critics of the Paxton boys rejected all of those arguments. They demanded concrete evidence supporting the contention that the Conestogas had been in league with the enemy. They insisted, like Franklin, on a profusion of different Native American tribes and nations, not just one kind. They insisted that skin color was irrelevant in judging people's character and allegiance. They ridiculed the supposed bravery of the Paxton boys who had massacred the Indians, and neatly reversing the accusation that Quakers were unfit to govern, they identified what they saw as a long Presbyterian tradition of subversion and fanaticism dating back to the English Wars of the 17th century. So the pamphlet war becomes a whole commentary on the civil wars of the previous century. The contending parties agreed that the Paxton affair had triggered the crisis, but they disagreed on who was responsible or how to resolve it. And it was at this point that Benjamin Franklin made one of his few political miscalculations. Maybe his only one, but certainly he blundered in this case. Pennsylvania, he proposed, should be placed under direct royal government as an antidote to the Penn family and Presbyterians. So the way to get out of this logjam was just to turn it into a royal colony. He ran on that platform in the election of 1764, and not only lost his own seat, but lost the campaign. He left Philadelphia for London straight away and spent the next 11 years there. The Paxton boys went unpunished. Nobody was investigated for the Conestoga massacres, let alone arrested or prosecuted. Like-minded settlers had carte blanche to behave in similar ways, and the result was wave after wave of violence on the Pennsylvania frontier. Okay, so to conclude, there are a few happy endings in Native American history, and this evening's story is no exception. I hope it's not too depressing. The story does have one significant twist at the end of the tale, which is that Benjamin Franklin and the Paxton boys ended up supporting the same side in the American Revolution. So let me just briefly explain that. So the year 1763 is a familiar turning point in American history. It marks the beginning of the Revolutionary era, and the standard narrative runs from the First Peace of Paris in 1763, ending the French and Indian War, through the Stamp Act crisis, the Boston Massacre, Lexington and Concord, the glories of the Revolution itself, the Second Peace of Paris, and the Constitution. Benjamin Franklin was one of the leaders of that revolution, returning to Philadelphia with impeccable timing in 1775, this time not to demand that royal government be imposed on Pennsylvania, but that it be overturned in the colonies as a whole. And many Ulster Presbyterians in eastern Pennsylvania joined him in that cause. But a second parallel revolution unfolded in the west along the frontier. The Paxton boys joined the Patriot side in the revolution, but not for lofty ideological motives. They continued to fight against the privilege of the Penn family for the same reasons that had animated them in the 1760s: land, personal security, and vengeance against Native Americans. John Elder and Matthew Smith, John Armstrong, Lazarus Stewart they all rallied to the Patriot side and fought in the revolution. Now, earlier historians made much of the western counties under representation in the Pennsylvania Assembly. But this, the Paxton Boys had included this as a grievance in their remonstrance in 1764, that relative to the size of the population, they had very low representation in the Assembly. That's true, but the remonstrance contains 8 grievances, and the other 7 have to do with Native Americans. And political representation, it seems, was an abstraction compared to the more fundamental need for self-preservation and land. The idea that the Paxton Boys were precursors of Republican Revolution was, however, brutally accurate in one sense. The American Revolution did more than destroy oligarchy and proprietary privilege in colonial Pennsylvania. It doomed the region's Native American population. And in some ways, the logic of the Paxton Boys in 1763 was writ large. During the Revolution, most Native Americans feared the Americans more than the British at that time, and many fought with the British. That's an unpleasant note on which to finish, but a realistic one, and I think it shouldn't surprise us, because just as the existence of slavery helped define the meaning of freedom in the revolutionary era, I think the story that I'm telling about Native American history does something very similar. So thank you very much.